You're listening to Market Champions, a podcast on navigating the financial markets. Here's your host, Srivasa Prakash.
This episode of Market Champions is brought to you by Simplify ETFs. For more information, go to simplify.us. No Simplify ETFs will be discussed in this episode. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Market Champions. Today I've got my friend Ken Miller. Ken is a portfolio manager at Simplify. Ken, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It is fantastic to have you on.
Yep, thank you, Sri, for having me.
Yep. Awesome. You know, Ken, let's kick it off by talking a bit about your background. You know, you studied applied mathematics for your undergrad. And, you know, as time has gone on, you know, math has sort of become, you know, one of the more foundational sort of subjects when it comes to working in finance, but sort of the shift towards quant, et cetera. So, you know, could you talk a bit about your background, you know, what drove you to finance and sort of, you know, your career and, you know, how you ended up at Simplify?
Sure. I came out of UC Berkeley in the late 80s as an applied math. And really the goal there was to be a computer science major. And my first job was working in the aerospace industry with Martin Marietta Manned Space Systems, is where we built the space shuttle external fuel tank, the large orange fuel tank that attaches to the space shuttle. And why is that important? It's just a very, you know, visible, tangible kind of product, and you know, that came out of that generation, that era, you know, that was a big field for many people coming out in with engineering degrees, a software engineering degrees, and you know, I worked there for 3 years, and as I saw the program kind of just. Aerospace in general, that was right around the time that the Cold War was kind of wrapping up. I decided to make the shift into finance by pursuing an MBA. I went to the University of Southern California, USC, you know, figured that I would get into some type of technology type field, most likely like a consulting with one of the big six consulting firms. And while I was at school there, one of my professors, you know, told me, hey, there's this bond firm down in Orange County named PIMCO. The guy down there is Bill Gross. Give him a call, you know, give Bill Gross a call. And I was like, oh, like bonds, like, and I started reading about bonds. I read Frank Fabozzi's book. And, you know, what really kind of excited me was mortgage-backed securities, particularly collateralized mortgage obligations, CMOs. And that was kind of my specialty, as I kind of like my personal specialty. Even though I wasn't trading those, I was able to get into a role at a small bank or division of a large bank, rather. LaSalle National Bank was a subsidiary of ABN AMRO, a large Dutch bank, which was trading commercial mortgage-backed securities. So that was how I made the leap into finance. I was there for about 2 years, and then I was able to join PIMCO in the analytics group and work there for about 3 years. And then, of course, you know, for those who have been in the markets a long time, know what happened in 1999. That was the euro common currency introduction, and we didn't have a very good system. No one did, whether PIMCO or anyone had a good system for trading foreign currency bonds and risk, or for analyzing the risk, rather. And they asked me to integrate our analytics for the common currency bonds into our trading desk, onto the trading desk. And that's how I became a trader. I started in 2000, roughly the year 2000. And you know, what's interesting is we were trading all of the non-dollar interest rates as well as FX. And, you know, I remember there being these countries that were very illiquid at the time, and Greece, Italy, you know, those kinds of sovereign debt that you thought, oh, wow, there's nice spreads here. It's pretty tight. It's like 25 over buns, you know? And of course, in 2013 or 11 rather, and then on into 2013, those spreads blew out from the standpoint of that, Greece wound up being basically defaulting, having to have private sector, write downs. So I'm kind of encapsulated a lot of time there, but during my span of time at PIMCO from 2000 to 2018, and I like I said, I started at PIMCO in '96. I was on the trading desk for 18 years, trading a variety of things, but spent a lot of time trading non-dollar foreign exchange derivatives, and then over to equity derivatives at the tail end of my career. And that's what launched me into two spin-offs. And I say spin-offs, I mean partners from PIMCO who had left to found their own investment managers firms. The one prior to Simplify was Longtail Alpha, which was founded by Vinir Bonsali, who I worked with at had really the privilege of working with at PIMCO. And I was there for a while, and I think we had a good approach. It didn't take off initially like I had hoped, and Simplify came to me and offered me a role, and that's how I end up here. So that's pretty much the synopsis of my career. Anything that sounds interesting or
No, it all sounds super interesting. And, Vinir is sort of super respected just within the tail risk. He sort of wrote the seminal book, Tail Risk Hedging. So he's, that is amazing. And, when it comes to, so, when it comes to your career at PIMCO, were you still within mortgage bonds and, mortgage securities during the housing boom and, sort of the 2008 financial crisis, or had you sort of made your shift to the sovereign bonds and, non-dollar FX, et cetera, by then?
Well, it's interesting, that even though I had had that interest in mortgage-backed securities, the MBS desk was very well staffed at PIMCO during the housing crisis. The current CIO at PIMCO, Dan Iveson, was, instrumental in navigating PIMCO through that period. At that time, I was focused on non-dollar debt. So, even though I had an interest in MBS, like I was not actively involved at PIMCO in that market. There were, situations where we held some non-agency debt in some of our global portfolios where we would interact with the MBS desk to say, wow, this is trading 70 cents on the dollar, 60 cents on the dollar. Should we buy this? That was in coordination, obviously, with some of the specialists over there. But that was the only interaction that I had during the crisis. I mean, my role during the crisis was to navigate a lot of the secondary mark-to-market issues that related from running books, running, a term that we hear a lot here at Simplify is stacking returns, which we used to call it portable alpha. And what portable alpha, one of the cornerstones of portable alpha at PIMCO was to take the total return type of stream of funds, take that small amount, when I say small amount of alpha, 150 to 200 basis points a year of alpha is great. And that was what PIMCO was consistently generating, and convert that to, foreign currency equivalents. So we have an investor in Australian dollar who wants to buy, the global aggregate and bonds, but get it hedged into Aussie dollar. So during the financial crisis, there was, as you can imagine, when currencies sold off dramatically, and there was a flight to the US dollar, these hedges into the base currency, Australian dollar to euro, obviously experienced some substantial losses, and I was involved in that, collateralization process, the mark to market, shifting of risk around inside of those portfolios during the crisis. So since you
Uh-huh.
asked me specifically about what did I do during the 2008 crisis, that was a big part of what I did. Not to mention, I traded interest rate derivatives. We had a lot of counterparty risk with Lehman and others, and that was a lot to navigate as well. So that was how that crisis touched me.
Uh-huh. And do you have any sort of war stories from your time at PIMCO? Especially considering that you work very closely with Bill Gross, and Bill Gross is sort of a hero or a legend in the fixed income and bonds world.
Yeah, very much. I see the Canadian flag behind you, and I will say that, as I mentioned, I was a non-dollar specialist, and in conjunction with others, obviously, that were very deeply involved in the Canadian bond market. I sat because I traded a lot of liquid products, liquid currencies, obviously extremely liquid, foreign interest rate futures, most notably, the Bunds, Baubles, which is the 5-year Germany, the front end of Europe, which is the Euribor, short sterling, all of those types of which is the equivalent of euro dollars. I sat in close proximity to the CIOs, to Bill and Mohammed, both of which were really a joy and just a daily challenge, which was fun to work with. And not too many, I wouldn't call them war stories. I mean, you felt like you were in a trench with a lot of risk flying over your head and a lot of quick questions. And especially with all of the what happened during those crisis periods. But we would get orders that would be to transact in the Canadian bond market, for example, into instruments that were not necessarily the most liquid, but we would utilize different ways of getting things done. We had a nice team that was able to help us do that, to participate in auctions. And I remember my role being very much a little bit of like a quarterback across, different desks. Like, well, I've got to call the head of the gilt desk over in the UK. We want to buy something in this auction. Bill wants to buy something in this auction. Or we want to buy some provincials in Canada. We want to participate in the British Columbia auction, or there's those types of things. So those were some big ones. We were very big. One of the things that PIMCO was very good at doing was spotting where there was a structural type of flow in the market that might persist. And if you could get a trade which hit on three or four cylinders instead of just one, that was very attractive. I think one of the best, one of the two trades that I feel the most joy or just proud of in my time there were, which were very, very big, deep liquid trades, were in foreign exchange derivatives. I think Euro USD implied volatility reached like below a 5% implied volatility in 2007. And and this is many different individuals on the desk. I want to say something about a gentleman who was really instrumental in mentoring me, and that is Sudhi Mariappa, who is also still at PIMCO. Is very had been through ex long-term capital, had been through some very tough times in the markets. And we spot trades. I kind of went through a lot of the implementation details. You brought up earlier, Sri, about cheapest implementation. That's a huge thing about what we figured out and what we did. Is it, do you want to do it in spot? Do you want to have to delta hedge? Do you want to do it in a forward vol agreement? Those types of structures we spent a lot of time analyzing and a lot of time writing it and translating it down into a simple, presentable format for Bill and Muhammad and others. And that was my role. And not only that, trading it, right, executing it. But that being long volatility in the FX market, if you look on a chart at what the 1 year, 3 month and 1 year implied vol did, it exploded after that in euro. Also, the other big trade we did, which was to sell yen calls. There was a big interest rate differential between US dollars and yen. You had the interest rate differential in your favor. You had the volatility roll down in your favor. You had the basis roll down, which you've talked about, the cross-currency basis. It worked in your favor. And when you have 3 to 4 cylinders working in your favor, and this is, I'm kind of touching on what you asked at the beginning, that's the types of trades you want to look for, is, you know, and it has to be a very liquid trade that you can not only unwind, but another term you heard of a lot at PIMCO was self-liquidation. You know, trades that self-liquidate. You don't have to, you know, trade out of it. Are you going to pay a huge bid offer on the way out of these trades? And that's an important attribute. So I think I covered a lot right there, and I'm happy to address any more of questions that you might have relating to that. But that's, in a synopsis, I think the two big trades that I remember being part of that I felt, you know, I was intimately connected with and managing and navigating for the CIOs and for the firm.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, that idea of having 3 or 4 different cylinders, or, you know, different sort of thesis points or different things working in your favor. I think, you know, that's very cool. And it's a super cool framework to think about. You know, just on the point of euro and yen, I think we saw a sort of similar opportunity in sort of 2021, where we saw a dollar yen vol, implied vol, and euro USD implied vol, if I remember correctly. Both were, again, not very close to their all-time lows. And you know, it sort of presented a similar opportunity, at least in hindsight. You know, we had the Russia-Ukraine war, which sent vol on euro through the roof. You know, we've seen some crazy action with dollar yen throughout this year. So just overall, you know, it seems to just overall, you know, I thought that was very interesting to notice.
Definitely, it's it gives you some latitude if your view, if things don't work out. You want to have as many things working in your favor in a trade, right? And they're hard to find. I mean, it has to be something that, I mean, I think the other thing that I think about the Japanese yen, you know, situation in 2012, if you remember, that was when Prime Minister Abe came in, and Abenomics, yeah, and Abenomics. You know, that was one of the arrows, was to keep the currency or to weaken the currency. You know, sadly, we lost PM Abe, but, you know, that's an important thing to think about when you do put on trades, is what's working in my favor, what's liquid, how can I get out of this, how much will it cost me to get out of it?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And no, just on that note, you know, I'm also very curious. So, you know, when it comes to thinking about hedges and sort of cheap ways to hedge, or cheap optionality, cheap volatility, and what is sort of your framework for sort of finding those kind of opportunities? You know, where do you look, and how do you assess whether a hedge or an options position is cheap enough to put on, or sort of expensive enough to sell? You know, you gave the example of selling yen calls. So, you know, just both ways.
Yeah, I mean, you have to determine what you want to be in the vol markets. Like, do you want to be a provider of volatility? Do you want to be a buyer? I mean, the general kind of rule of thumb is that sellers of volatility, sellers of VIX, you know, VIX futures, there is, you know, you want to be a provider. You want to be a seller. I think that buyers of options generally come up short. You know, I think many people characterize it in different ways. You know, the street is working against you, time is working against you, you know, momentum is working against you. There are things that, you know, You always we used to say at PIMCO, you know, we want to be providers of vault. We have the ability to sell vault, to sell strangles on rates. We feel that rates are going to be in this range, or currencies will be in this range, whatever. So when you decide that you are going to be a buyer of volatility, you have to. So you're keeping in mind that that's going against the grain a little bit. You have to have a lot of things working in your favor, and that, you know, that could be an extremely strong conviction about the direct about what the markets will do, whatever it is you're buying options on, and you know, a horizon where you can handle the decay, depending on in an option. So that's I'm talking about if you want to be a purchaser. I mean, if you want to be a seller, you know, that's you're exposed then to tail risk in a way, right? You're you have to be to understand at what point. I think the an important thing to keep in mind is you have to have a level at which you will do this ex ante. You have to say, you know, I like the VIX, you know, or let's say the October VIX or November VIX. I like it at 29.67. If it gets to 30, I'm going to sell it. I'm talking about the VIX futures. I'm just picking that as an example. So you have to, in your mind, go in, and that's the right way to trade. You don't want to when it gets to 30, you don't want to be thinking, oh, well, maybe it'll go to 32, you know, and I'm going to sell it there. You have to have it in your mind. I'm a seller at 30. I'm a buyer at 25. And that's you have to look at E-minis that way. You have to look at currencies that way. Go in with the level in mind. Don't, you know, and there's all types of strategies that relate to, well, the momentum in this particular asset is here and I'm going to buy it because, you know, but just know beforehand where what level you're going to get in and what level you're going to get out as well.
So,
Have a
you know,
target.
yep. And, you know, going back to the point you were making earlier, so I know you're saying that generally speaking, you should have, you know, generally speaking, you know, being long optionality tends to be hard, and you have time working against you, and the street is working against you, etc. I mean, I'm generally curious, I know over time, have you noticed that, that the profile of being short gamma or just in general short options has changed? Because, you know, for example, you know, one of the things that I don't know if people listening to the podcast might be aware of, but you know, one of the things that happened in the middle of the 2010s was there used to be this website called optionsellers.com, which was essentially a hedge fund focused around selling options and selling selling uncovered options. And essentially the fund blew up because you know, it's sort of I think there's sort of a saying, you know, it's not delta that kills you, it's the gamma. And yeah, do you think the profile of being short gamma and being short options has changed over time?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I was looking at a, you know, good chart today that showed how what percentage of option expiries in the S&P options index options is, you know, inside of 24 hours at maturity, and it's gone up tremendously. I think it's in like a 40% range. You know, so that answers your question, like how has the gamma profile changed? Yes, because the shorter the options, obviously the larger the gamma component is to the option. And you know, I mean, with this type of, I mean, today felt like a day where you had some coordination between, you know, authorities, market participants, market commentators, about, you know, hey, maybe this. My point is that it's very hard to predict over one day what is going to, if you can make money over one day, like who knows what will happen tomorrow in or over the weekend in Ukraine? Who knows what will happen, you know, over the weekend in one of the political races? Or, you know, there's so many things that can happen in one day that override any legitimate view, that fundamental view, right, that might actually
Right.
pervade. So I think that it's very hard to make money over a short period of time in options now, because so much of the market is playing there, and there are just too many things that can happen in a 24 to 48 hour period, especially with the instability that I think we see geopolitically right now.
Yep. And one of the things that Mike Green has talked about over the last week is how we've sort of seen the exact shift you've described. So, people are trading very short dated options, with 4 days to expiry, and less. That is sort of a sign of low conviction trading, because it's very hard to tell, what's going to happen in markets, say over the next couple of weeks, or say over the next 3 months or 6 months, et cetera, with so much uncertainty. And I think that's sort of an interesting phenomenon to observe.
Absolutely, that is true. That that's the way of playing. Being long an option is a way of playing. I just don't know what's going to happen, but I know that I don't want to commit. One of the beauties of option trading is risk substitution. Calls are used as a substitution of an outright position, a fully capitalized position in stocks, right? Because I mean, most investors, right, are personally, you think, well, I'm just going to go out and I'm going to buy SPY, or I'm going to buy NASDAQ, or I'm going to buy Apple or Tesla. You're fully committing capital. You may do it in options, but in lieu of actually, if you are an investor whose benchmark is the FANG stocks or the S&P 500, you have to determine whether or not you're going to, if options are worth the commitment of risk to match your benchmark if you get a massive rally. And a lot of times, without that conviction, the option on the S&P is the only way you can do it. So I think that's why you're seeing that right now is there is, I would agree with Mike about the lack of conviction.
Yep, absolutely. And one of the other things is, so Hari Krishnan wrote a book called The Second Leg Down. And he's a vol trader, and I think he's a portfolio manager, CIO or something at SET Capital Management, or SET Trading Strategy. I think the name of the firm is SET, and I don't remember the suffix to that name. But he wrote a book called The Second Leg Down, where he sort of talked about strategies on how you can still you can profit, or you can hedge after the market starts to move down. And what he sort of described is what he sort of described is sort of a very interesting strategy, where you buy an OTM option that's less than 25 delta, put options with less than 4 days to expiry. And it seems like once is sort of the environment, and we've sort of started to see Simplify incorporate this sort of an approach to a lot of our products. So it sort of seems interesting. What are your thoughts on how you would go about hedging in a market, or thinking about hedging in a market that's already moved lower?
Well, the thing, one of the things we used to do is do a stress type of table or panel that told you, given the rally that we've seen, let's say today's rally from 3640 to 3770 in the S&P. So that's going up, right? I know you were talking down, but what other instruments that are highly correlated to a rallying stock market have not yet been, it's not been reflected. I mean, I look out here, obviously the dollar weakened today, so that makes sense. So maybe there's not so much opportunity there. Spreads tightened in investment grade and high yield bonds. Currency volatility, didn't really move that much. I mean, that's, could be a sell there. If you think, I mean, that I'd have to think about a lot though, because you got the BOJ, or sorry, the MOF, who was active today, right, in dollar yen. So you have to analyze and say, well, what are trades that, to build on what Mr. Krishnan said, is, what is the indirect, we used to call those indirect hedges, like an indirect correlated hedge. Like, something's already moved. What was the beta of high yield spreads or FX volatility or non-agency mortgage-backed security spreads, you know, or the cross-currency basis? You know, that one takes a lot longer to actually play out, obviously. But those are things that you want to look for when you have a big shock or after you've had a big drawdown, like you were talking in the markets. You say, well, what hasn't yet moved? Wow, FX volatility may be low, right? I could have been buying, you know, yen calls, you know, not necessarily cheaply. Relative to to long-term history, but those are things that we could have. Those would be the second leg down trades that I would think about. And I'm not highlighting anything in particular right now. I'm not. So if you're asking me for specific recommendations, I'm not going to be able to make them without doing a thorough analysis. I think you need to have the ability to look closely.
Yep. 100%. And, you know, just not, you know, just moving away from hedging, but still on the topic of options. Now, what are the ideas behind options? And this idea of convexity is that, you know, you can bet $2 in order to make $3, or you can risk $5 in order to make $10. You know, from your experience and your expertise within just the options world, you know, how do you think about structuring options positions that are the most optimal, in terms of the risk reward scenario, as it relates to your thesis and time horizon? You know, how do you think about, you know, going, because for example, you know, if you want to be long something, or, you know, let's say, you know, you believe that just hypothetically the S&P 500 is going to go up over, say, the next month. So that's sort of your thesis, you know, your time horizon is 1 month. But there's just so many different ways to play it. You know, for example, you know, if vol is high, or you think, you know, puts are super expensive, you know, you can make some money by selling puts. Or, you know, on the other hand, you could outright buy calls, or, you know, you could buy a call spread, et cetera. Or, you know, you could think about expressing it in a related market, as you were just saying. So, you know, how do you go about, you know, hunting for what the best expression of a thesis is, you know, keeping time horizon in mind, of course, within the options world?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of analyzing where things sit, where particular structures sit on, you know, on some type of normalized basis, to say, you know, I think the market's going to go up here, and I know that, and maybe a lot of people, market participants, think that too. And you know, one of the big dynamics in the market that you see right now is the collapse. Or narrow, or extreme narrowing. I won't say collapse. Extreme narrowing in the call versus put skew, where call volatility implies what you pay for calls is, you know, roughly, you know, is extremely low relative to where puts are for that same degree of out of the moneyness. So, you know, that those are things that I like to analyze to say, you know, does that type of condition warrant buying, you know, something that like a bullish trade, because you said I think the market's going to go up, a bullish trade that takes advantage of that condition. So maybe a call spread. You mentioned, you know, what'd you say? You said buying, you could buy a call, or you
Bye.
could sell a put rather, right? Like, yeah, I mean, put volatility is pretty elevated. Right. I mean, just as long as you can protect yourself in, you know, the event of, you know, a bad inflation report, right, that might come out. So, but I like looking at structures. I like looking at, you know, risk reversals, callers, you know, iron condors type of like, which are maybe like a derivation off of a straddle or a strangle that give you to say, I'm confident that. You know, this particular structure is at a two standard or two or three standard deviation level of cheapness historically. And for that reason, you know, I think that when you get to this level of pricing, that an analysis shows you that the trailing 30 to 60 days sees, you know, positive returns 70% of the time. So this is one thing that is really important, I think, is to say, there is no certainty, right? It's all about probability. You have to understand what is the probability that my view will take place. If but the probability, if I assume that, historically, the conditions that prevailed, at this point today relative to what it did in 2016 or 2018, in 80% of the scenarios where this situation was prevalent in the market's going to rally 80% of the time. That's all you can do. You can't say, with certainty. You can just say, an analysis shows me that when you get to this point, 80% of the time you have a so that gives you that tells you, 80% is a pretty good coin flip for me. I mean, if it's 52%, well, maybe not, right? I think that's an important thing to and those types of probability, and then evaluating everything else, Sri, like saying there's an 80% probability that stocks will be up, there's a 75% probability that Tesla will be up, there's a 60% probability that municipal bond spreads will tighten, all of these things. And you say, well, what's the best trade out there? How much risk am I willing to commit to it? How much loss am I willing to take on it if I'm wrong in the 20%, scenario that it doesn't transpire?
100%. And I think that's sort of the key, right? So you want to sort of work in a way where, even if you're wrong, you don't lose much, but then, when you're right, you're able to make, you're able to make multiples, or at least a positively convex outcome. And I think on that note, one of the key things that's interesting to think about is, so for example, I mean, I was reading a report. I think the last inflation number was last week. And so, the day before the inflation number, I was reading a report from one of the big banks, if I remember correctly, on how, even if there was a beat to the inflation number, a lot of that or a lot of the stagflation was sort of already priced into stuff like bonds and gold, etc. And so, even if you were to see a beat, you're not really going to see it move much. But if you were going to see a miss, considering what's priced in, those expectations are going to change, and you're sort of going to see the converse happen, where you say, yields would decline, gold would decline, etc. So, when it comes to figuring out what is priced in already into markets, how do you go about thinking and sort of finding that?
What you want to do is view things in a table with a many assets over many different horizons, saying that positioning is a big thing, which you mentioned. Crowded trades, extremely important to know what are crowded trades, what are individuals betting on a higher a CPI beat versus a miss, like you said. Those are big pieces of information you need to have in your tool of analysis to say, I can tell that, if we don't get a 9% inflation number, that the market's going to rally big, even though that's maybe above expectations. So positioning is a very, very big thing. Positioning in funds, positioning it. What really is so interesting to me is my entire career that I kind of summarized for you earlier has been in finding those second order, third order assets, relationships. Like, I'm not going to sit here and say that, I mean, everybody's watching inflation, everybody's trading stocks, E-minis, right? That it's impossible for me to say that. That's not, I've never had that role in my career. Like, I've never been the person to say, hey, Ken, if CPI beats, what do you think S&P will do? I mean, I don't think like that. I think, what do I think dollar yen's going to do? What do I think dollar yen vol's going to do? What do I think bunds are going to do? What do I think, the instruments that I trade, Canadian provincials, what's going to happen there? What's the BOC going to do? So you're going to like patient zero when you talk about the E-minis, right? And CPI. And these are things that there is just too many variables for, and that's the fun thing. That is the root of all of it, right? So if you have the right call there, you can kind of predict. But that touches back to about your kind of secondary, second leg down type of analysis to say, Yeah, everyone's going to trade E-minis and TY for you, 10-year futures on a CPI surprise. But what have they not traded? What's missing? What else is out there? And that's what my role has always been, historically, before my role at Simplify. So it's hard. What you're saying to do is very hard to. How do you structure? How do you know? But the more you look at it, the other thing that is very important to, and I know you've heard this before, but it's what is not captured in the information. No one knew about, only a few people knew about how poor the underwriting standards were in 2007 and why a real estate market crashed, right? Or, or what the degree of leverage was at Lehman. These kinds of things that who is there are things that is what is or like would the LIBOR OIS spread blow out? These are things that they're kind of, well, it's the risk that you don't see that you need to be able to anticipate. So I would say try to think of things that you're not able to that have not yet surfaced that might surface. And that's the difficult part, I think. Everybody knows now to look at, positioning and how many options are trading inside of a day and, flows, those types of things. But it's what are we not looking at? Like would there be a pandemic? I mean, that was, who could call that one, right? But I'm just saying there are things that are unforeseen.
Yep, 100%. And just on that note, what are you seeing in, these crazy markets today? So, especially within the option space in terms of positioning, skew, etc. Anything else that you watch? And just overall, you said that, LIBOR OIS, TET spread, everyone watches that. What is something that you watch that is usually, not watched, or, people typically don't pay attention to? It's the Ken secret sauce.
No, that's tough. I mean, I think I've kind of touched on it a little bit. I think that the types of things we talked about with low conviction, maybe buying of call options because that's a call substitution instead of being long the market. It's a cheap way, a levered way to get long the market. I think those are overpriced. I think the sales being willing to sell the upside off, overwriting is the term that's called is attractive right now. I mean, a lot of people think that. That's not there's nothing secret about that. That could be completely wrong. The market has been beaten down dramatically. That might be the right trade to be long calls. But I think that that's probably a little overpriced right now. The market's certainly reflecting the expensiveness of calls. I think what you see is many retail investors are shocked about, and this is maybe not necessarily options related, but retail investors are shocked about how, geez, I was in bonds because I thought stocks would do, I kind of figured stocks would do badly, and I've been nervous since COVID, so I'm in bonds. Well, wow, now you're sitting on on the same size losses. I think Bill Gross wrote an article about it, about that total return funds and bonds are charging 50 basis points but delivering terribly negative returns in line with the bond indexes. So, I mean, my point is that these are things that investors may panic on the back of that. Investors may not be aware of other things out there that they can take advantage of. I think Simplify offers a nice suite of products that, given a view, enable you to utilize options in a very liquid, transparent platform to speculate, on what you think the market's direction be, up or down.
Yep, 100%. And I think that's what's super cool about Simplify, the way we're able. I mean, obviously we can't mention tickers on the podcast, but one of the cool things is how we use options, and we sort of give it in a sort of a retail ETF wrapper that anyone can go ahead and use. So I think that's what's super cool. That's one of the very cool things about
Absolutely.
it. Yeah. Awesome.
Yes.
With that, Ken, one more thing that is interesting is, when it comes to the positioning of equity is, one of the things that I've continually read is on how, the market in terms of positioning has been incredibly, incredibly bearish. And just as a function of that, the chances of something like a short squeeze happening on any sort of good news, say, good inflation print, et cetera, that may good as in a miss on inflation, which may or the Fed being dovish, et cetera, that could really set off some sort of a short squeeze. And I think that's one of the structural risks that's very interesting to pay attention to in the market right now. Where positioning is heavily lopsided on the short side.
Would definitely agree with that. I think many out there are waiting for relief from this. It could be a variety of things. I mean, we've got an extremely heavy calendar coming up in the next month with midterm elections, and what's going to happen. Like we talked about Europe, we've got the winter coming up in Europe, and sabotage on pipelines and war, and so if any of that eases, then I think you could see some, people that have been waiting to buy, could quickly flood back in. So that's why you've seen people buying calls, right? It's they know that this could happen, but obviously the overriding risk has been to the downside, because of inflation. But positioning is quite bearish, and I don't think, however, though, that I think that the my sense is that the retail selling is pretty much done. I mean, that's in disagreement with many, I think, especially here. I think we might be waiting, and certainly, if something disastrous happens in Europe or anywhere, then obviously you're going to want to sell. Like, I mean, personally, I have a longer term perspective. I'm holding on to my equity positions. I'm holding on to my bond positions in my personal funds, but that could change. That calculus could change very quickly if someone else gets, if this war widens, for example, or if we have a resurgence of COVID, or some strange result in the midterm elections that, really amplify a fiscal issue that we might have, or a monetary issue.
Yep, 100%. And on that note, Ken, it was fantastic having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for being on and being generous with your time and sharing, your thoughts on the options world, how you structure trades, as well as sort of your lessons from, your years at PIMCO, Long Tail Alpha and Simplify. So, it was awesome. It was awesome getting the opportunity to interview you. Thank you so much.
Sri, thank you. This was fun, and I really appreciate your willingness to talk to me.
Thank you for listening to Market Champions. To never miss an episode, make sure to subscribe, and we'll see you next time.